I had a wonderful time recently with a dear lifelong friend. He would be in my very short list of people that are my very, very lifelong friend. I have a lot of friends that come in and go out of my life, which you could probably analyze and find that I'm the problem there, but maybe not. In this case, we've been friends up and down and thick and thin and happy and sad. And he's enduring. And he will finish well. And I want to be like my friend. And I'm not talking about the Apostle Paul, though I will in a moment. But I bring that up on the front end to remind you of this, that everything we read in God's Word, though it tells us about people that once lived, the Pauls, the Peters, the Ezra, the Esther, the, you know, pick your person. In fact, recently in a personality profile that uses biblical characters, I'm most closely aligned with Deborah in the Old Testament. How's that for you, huh? I married a Deborah. That's kind of cool, actually. So, but those people, though they were real and true and they lived and they survived, and Hebrews chapter 11, if you need a refresher course, go there, and you will see one after another who finished having endured to the finish, to the end. And it's a really cool thing to do, but sometimes we go, well, that was then, that was them. And I'm here to tell you, my friend last week reminded me, no, that's here and that's now, and there are real people like that. And though my friend is not with us in this gathering this morning, can I tell you, if you look around this room, there are some serious survivors. There are men and women who walk with Jesus Christ and who, through the Holy Spirit, have love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control every single day. And they're here. They're here. They're with us. Is that cool? So just look around you. And if you need me to give you a name of somebody that you can have coffee with so they can sort of infuse you with something to keep going, just call me. And there are plenty of them that I can point you to. That said, I want to take you to a time in our recent memory as a nation and ask a question. How can one guy win 16 Olympic medals, 14 of which were gold? And it took him, there were so many medals in his collection, it took him not one but two Olympics, the Athens Games and the Beijing Games, to amass such a huge number of medals. How did he do it? Likely the most common question, in fact, that the 6'4", 200-pound Michael Phelps was asked by interview after interview after interview. How'd you do it? What's your secret? Was it in the water? Actually, yes. That's where he won all of them, okay, just for the record. People wondered about his diet. Was it in the diet? You mean the 12,000 calories he consumed daily? Y'all, that's more than a week for most of us, right? Or should be. Today it won't be, just for the record, because today's my favorite day in our church. Did I tell you that? It's the women's bake sale, and I've had the hardest time this week watching my wife bake things, and I'm like, yeah, and she goes, no, stay away. This is for the church on Sunday, and I'm like, I'm leaving that church. It's a great day. Go next door. It's all gluten-free, sugar-free, fat-free, and glorious, and it's, and yeah, so back to Michael Phelps. What was his deal? Was it just that he is a freakishly superhuman with skill that just went off the charts? Now, while it's true, he in fact was born with an anatomical edge over other swimmers. And I won't bore you with the details, but longer arms and cool things that make him really swim like dolphins, right? But it was likely something else. In fact, most certainly something else. What was it? Well, In the words of Michelangelo, the 16th century Italian sculptor, painter, architect, poet, he did it all. Quote, "If people knew how hard I had to work to gain my mastery, it would not seem so wonderful at all." Michelangelo was amazing, not because he was born that way. Neither was Michael Phelps. Seems that was his story as well. How many of us are willing to swim 6 hours a day, 6 days a week for a total of, ready, 50 miles in the pool per week? I did the math. That's more than my commute to work in a week. Now, in another Olympics, sprinter Eric Liddell, you remember the name? His story was captured in the Oscar-winning film Chariots of Fire. He was asked, where does this power come from to see the race to the finish? And he repeated his answer again and again. It comes from within. So what can two, not one, but two Olympic champions and a world-famous artist teach us about following Jesus? That's why I told those stories. Well, it turns out plenty. And it's not surprising that as you turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 9, page 798 in our Bibles, it's not surprising that an analogy used by one of those greats, super swimmers of his day, Paul, the apostle, he used an analogy for this journey with Jesus. The analogy is a race. He called it a race. And he describes this race in the ninth chapter of 1 Corinthians, his first letter. Now, in this chapter, the apostle has been describing at great lengths the great lengths to which he went in order to reach people with the gospel. Now, digest that statement. It's not just autopilot. It doesn't just happen on its own. These are great lengths to which this apostle went about reaching as many people as possible. He was single-mindedly focused on seeing how many people he could win to Jesus. Now think about that. While you do, look for the word win, W-I-N, as I read verse 19 and following. See if you can count how many times he uses that simple word. Though I am free and belong to no one, I've made myself a slave to everyone to win as many as possible. To the Jews, I became like a Jew to win the Jews. To those under the law, I became like one under the law. Though, for the record, I'm myself not under the law. I did this so as to win those under the law. To those not having the law, I became like one not having the law. And for the record, though I am not free from God's law, but I am under Christ's law. And I did this, once again, to win those not having the law. Verse 22, to the weak I became weak, to win the weak. I become all things to all people so that by all possible means I might save or win some. I do all of this for the sake of the gospel that I may share in its blessings. How many did you count? Six. Six times in these short verses, he talks about winning people to Jesus. Even a casual read there, you got to go, that's a big deal to him. So much so that you probably picked up on another word that repeats five times throughout that passage I just read. He says, I became. I became. To the Jews, I became. To those under the law, I became. To those without law, I became. He's describing a strategy, an approach that he took every day to win as many people as possible to Christ. What's that strategy? It's adapting and adjusting to whoever it is that I work with, that I live near, that I know at school, I adjust, I adapt. And he summarizes it in verse 22 that we read already. I am, notice this, all in. To the weak I became weak, to win the weak I've become all things to all people, so that by all possible means I may save some. You could say from what we just read quickly here, Paul was all in to win. That was his approach. Now, let's be clear. That's not always easy. In a complex, complicated world like you and I live in, which demands our constant attention, only the trouble is it's not in one direction, right? You got stuff going on later today, and then tomorrow hits. And then, you know, right now some of you are looking for someone in this room that looks super cool and therefore it gives a some sort of an impression that they have air conditioning in their home, which you don't. And so you're hoping they'll invite you over. So if you have air conditioning in your home, raise your hand so somebody can identify you. Good. Okay, they're on their way to your place today. So is that how you live for Jesus? Let me just ask it. I mean, let's use words like boldly, engaged in people's lives with the gospel. I could list all the places that you and I go. But do you realize, your children are on sports teams. When you go to, are you not just having them participate on that team, but are you saying, this is a chance for us to win people to Jesus, to adapt and adjust, to become all things to those people on the team? Are you the first, when you see a need or hear somebody, maybe they come to your door, as a woman did one time, dissolved in tears at our doorstep and broken. And she was an alcoholic and had hit bottom. She absolutely knew nowhere to turn. She was there with her mother. She's probably 40. Mother was, you know, a little older. And we just take hands at the door. And we start praying. And I peeked. I looked down in this little circle, and there's just drops of tears hitting the porch. And that was the turning point in that woman's life. Here's the deal. Do you realize everywhere you go, when you respond to somebody in pain or struggle, you adapt to their situation and their challenge? Do you realize you have the answer? It's not just you and your force of your personality showing up. It's you showing up with the answer. And who is that? Jesus. You get to show up and say, you know, I don't know. I don't know how to help, but I know somebody that can. Now, back to verse 22, because I'm perplexed by this. It's clear about what's involved. And it took everything. Paul was all in, as I said earlier. So what are we going to call verse 22? When he says, I became all things to all people that I might by all possible means save some. But let's give it a word. Grit. Would you write that word down? Because you're going to get to know grit for the next few moments. Simple G-R-I-T. I'm going to call this the secret sauce to which Paul points to in how he was able to live like this. How did you do it, Paul? If he were to be interviewed, I think his answer would be, I did it with grit. In fact, I think he'd go a step further. It took grit, and all grit comes from God. Look with me at verse 24 as we read on. Do you not know that in a race all the runners run, but only one gets the prize? Run in a way that you win. That's what he's saying, verse 25, the 24. Run in such a way as to get that prize. Everyone who competes in the games goes into strict training. They do it to get a crown that will not last. But we do it to get a crown that will last and last and last forever. Therefore, I do not run like somebody running aimlessly. I do not fight like a boxer beating the air. I thought of Muhammad Ali passing this week, and he was float like a butterfly, sting like a bee, right? And he did it. He did it with purpose. He fought with a focus. Verse 27. I strike a blow to my body. The term there in Greek is I beat myself black and blue into submission. I strike a blow to my body that I make it my slave, and I do this so that after I've preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified for the prize. It's a sure bet that Paul would have said if asked, where does that power come from to finish this race, to do so much on a day-to-day basis? Where do you get it, Paul? And I think his answer would be, as I've said already, it's called grit and it comes from God. That's where I get it. So let's go further. What is grit? It is courage and resolve, both necessary because enduring to the finish is not a guaranteed outcome. Can I say that again? And that might trip some of you up theologically, but I thought I was a shoe-in. I thought I had my ticket punched. I thought I, know Jesus and I can just shift into neutral and coast to the finish line. Let me repeat myself. Enduring to the finish isn't a guaranteed outcome. To win the prize, verse 24, what Paul's talking about, isn't the same as receiving a trophy for participating on a grade school sports team. Well, you get a trophy. Why? I didn't even play. Yeah, but you were on the team. Notice Paul's words that point to what is required. And there are three that I want to draw your attention to. First one in verse 25, we've read it already. Strict training. Do you circle those words? Everyone who competes in the games goes into strict training. Well, what's the opposite of strict training? Casual. Hey, I go to the club. Oh, really? When do you go? Well, it was like back in March. And then I was there. Oh, no, I was there in May too. Yeah. That's not strict training. Well, I've been busy. That's called laissez-faire. You show up when you got nothing else going. Okay, that's true at the club. That's been true of my experience at the club. There are times when I'm all about it and just, can't get enough. And then there's times when I'm just, watching reruns of Andy Mayberry or something to get out of it. So strict training is what we're talking about. Here's the deal. To finish the way he's talking about, you don't saunter to the finish line. No, it's strict training. What's being described here in verse 25, everyone who competes in the games goes into strict training, is the ancient version of swimming 50 miles a week. I read an excellent article when we were camping, and my daughter picks up magazines on airplanes that people leave, and I've never read this magazine, The Atlantic. I don't know, maybe some of you get, but it was full of cool articles, and this one, I read an article from a research professor, Angela Duckworth, of the University of Pennsylvania. And in her forthcoming book entitled Grit, which is where I got that idea, she argues that, quote, grit is perseverance plus the exclusive pursuit of a single passion. Grit is perseverance plus, see my hands? It's called tunnel vision. The exclusive pursuit of a single passion. That's what Paul understood when he exhorted, run in such a way, verse 24, as to win. That's an exclusive pursuit, running in such a way as that is your exclusive or single passion. Is that how you live out God's will in this, our last sermon, last message in this series? So, rather than a hit and miss, rather than I get there sometime, but not all the time? Is it something that's so dialed in and dialed up in your heart that you say, I want to go all out. I want to have this grit to persevere and to live it out. Today's message, enduring to the finish. It's going to take more than just, you know, the laissez-faire approach. Here's a second principle, okay? Strict training followed by verse 26, a singular focus. Professor Duckworth expressed a similar idea in what she called directional consistency. Can't wait for her book to come out, as a matter of fact. It's the ability to stick unswervingly to a single, I love this word, superordinate goal over a period of years. Meaning a more important, you have a lot of goals? A superordinate goal says it's more important than the rest. It doesn't diminish or discredit other goals. It simply says in the world of goals, some really, really matter, a superordinate goal, and others not as much. That's her word. She then adds this. This exclusive pursuit is the single, in a single passion, is a seriously underrated component of success. Let me break it down this way. Is Kobe Bryant amazing? You may not like him because you're from Portland. You know, I get that. But was he an amazing basketball player? Hands up. So there's some really bitter people here. No one's hands going up. He put the hurts to us more than a few times. So, Cope, let's switch it up. Who else is great? Michael Phelps, great swimmer. You all agreed with that analogy, okay? What I said at the beginning, great because he was born that way? Or great because he strived? Strove, I guess, is the right word, right? To be great. Yeah, is the answer. Okay? Let's be honest. Kobe has a little more game than I do. Just a little, but he did. He showed up with that. Right? But you hear him talk. My son worked for the Trailblazers, and when the Lakers would come to town, one time he was in the locker room, and Kobe had a frustrating previous game, I think in Sacramento or something, and he calls out my Trevor and says, Trevor, or didn't know his name, he says, hey, come work me out a little bit. They go in the court, it's just the two of them, and Trevor, who's ripped, he starts rebounding for Kobe, all right? Kobe took shot after shot after shot after shot. Shall I go on? It went on for an hour and a half in the area that he bombed the night before. And guess what happened? He nailed it that night, unfortunately. It was the Blazers. My son reported to me, I said, what was that like? He says, oh, it's just like a dream come true. He says, he looked right through me, Dad. And I said, what else did it feel like? He says, I am exhausted. Right? Just from rebounding. I'm like, come on, you wuss. You know, you can rebound. That's not a big deal. He goes, Dad, you first few passes back, I just kind of bounce pass or something. He goes, no, snap it to me. Like this for an hour and a half. Exhausted. You getting it? Why was Kobe great? This is not a sermon about Kobe. This is about how you and I can endure to the finish. Some of us show up with a little bit more to work with. Some don't. But guess what? All of us can strive. All of us can have a singular focus. And that's what he's saying when he says, don't run aimlessly or fight without a focus, verse 26. Why? Because there's a prize at stake. I still remember, Debbie, when we would take walks as a family. We might be at the mall, or we had something to do, and we had to get on with it. I remember Debbie sort of using this expression, and it kind of changed how we were going. It moved us from first gear to at least third gear to get there. She would say, come on, walk with a purpose. And I'm like, yeah, kids. And she'd say, well, no, I was talking about you. You know, kind of thing. Walk with a purpose. So, do you walk with a purpose? Third necessity, verse 27. Self-control. It's not actually written there, but is that not what verse 27 is saying? Strike a blow to my body, make it my slave. so that after I've preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified for the prize. Can I describe this as a mountain? Self-control. You want to endure to the finish? The biggest mountain for you to climb is self. You've got to overcome self. You've got to find a way to say no to self, and with it, to sin. Sin does not own you. Sin does not have the upper hand on you. If you're a follower of Jesus Christ, he has made you an overwhelming conqueror to sin. It is actually possible to say no to sin and mean it. It's really true. Now, notice, I want you to see a word here he uses at the end of this sentence. See, disqualified for the prize. That's Paul saying, I understand what's at stake. There's a lot riding on this. I don't want to be disqualified. What is that word? Well, it's the same word if you look to the fifth verse of the next chapter. Paul has been talking in this new chapter, chapter 10. He's talking about the children of Israel, how they had everything. But look what happened in verse 5. Nevertheless, God was not pleased with most of them. The expression not pleased with most of them is the same Greek word as verse 27, being disqualified. You say, well, what's that look like then? Break that down. Paul is talking about self-control that's needed so that he will not be disqualified, or let me put it in terms, that he will not be a disappointment to his heavenly Father. Why do I do this? He doesn't mention these words, but he knew them. In Matthew chapter 25, when Jesus was talking about servants, some walked well, some walked off the path. And remember, they all came back one day, and Jesus, one by one, said to the first two and then to the third, first two, well done. Remember those words? Matthew chapter 25, verse 23. Well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful with a few things. I'm now going to put you in charge of many things. Welcome. I'll welcome and come and share in my happiness. But to the third one, he says, not so much. Depart from me. You let me down. My expectations were up here for you. And you didn't meet them. Paul, though he longed to hear in his own life those words one day, welcome home, Paul, my good and faithful servant. Welcome into my presence and enjoy my happiness forever. He feared that he would hear instead one day, poorly done, Paul. I'm disappointed. This caused Paul to see the value of self-control. Can I correct an assumption if you're thinking, well, that's a guilt trip? No. You know what I'm trying to do is introduce to you in the end of this series the reality of regret. It's real. It's the person that saunters through life and comes to the end, and they have good days and bad days, but mostly sort of, you know, mediocre days, and they look back and go, oh! And they want to do what they can't do. They want to do over. I don't live a day like that. I just don't. I heard somebody tell me yesterday at the men's drag race out in the parking lot. He said he comes home. He comes home from work, and his grandson was home, full of energy, a little guy, and he came home just wanted to, exhausted from work. And the little guy says, "Yo, Grandpa, you know, come on, Papa, let's go play basketball." And he's thinking, "Why don't I just run in front of cars on the freeway?" You know, I mean, he's just gassed. He's out. But he found a way to pull from within and say, I'm going to press forward. Because I don't want to go late in life and look back and go, oh, man, he's grown up. He hasn't asked me to play ball in years. That's good stuff. I I want to tell you, I grew up with a father that I never a single day feared. And I recognize some of you have a different story than that. I didn't fear my father. Even though he would spank me when I needed it, and one time I was on restrictions for life, you know, that kind of stuff. But I didn't fear him. But I lived with a desire to never disappoint him. And it helped me make wise choices when I was really flirting with some dumb ones. For the record, I chose some dumb ones along the way. Yeah. But it was not wanting to disappoint my dad. Not fear getting creamed or something dumb. Just didn't want to disappoint my dad. I wanted to walk well. I wanted him to be proud of me. I think that's what Paul's telling us here. It was true of Paul. In order for that outcome to happen for me or for you, it takes grit. Given by God. You can't just gut it out. That's superhuman. There's no one that's going to do that with success. But it involves strict training, singular focus, and self-control. If you're going to endure to the finish. Because you and me, like Paul that we've read about, want to please your Heavenly Father and hear him say someday, you know, I'm really proud of you. I really am. I'm excited to spend forever with you. Let me say at the end, before we take communion together, I want to thank you for listening to this message. Because it's probably fairly evident to more than a few of you that I was really preaching to myself. About 90% of you are distracted by the child that's screaming wildly in the back. It's okay. As with every single message I've ever preached here, that I prepare and I present God's truth, I try to be razor specific and theologically airtight. It's never not been my goal. And this Sunday is no exception. I've always tried to follow the example of Ezra, the wonderful prophet of old. In chapter 7, verse 10, it says, Ezra studied God's word, and then he practiced it, and then he presented it. And I've been tempted forever to go from study to present, because that's easier. But God has kept me focused on the middle piece. And very true to my experience as a pastor is, along the way, when I'm preaching on something, whether it's, I could go on, pick a topic, God says, okay, got it, you understand what I'm saying, and my people need to hear that at Grace Point, but before they hear it, let's talk about you. Let's keep it real. So enduring to the end has been a message for me. It has. Ask most pastors, and the honest ones will tell you, ministry is grueling. It is a wearisome endeavor that, may I just say in the word I've been using this morning, requires a ton of grit. There's nothing more to the story than that. But a long time ago, in order to infuse me with the needed grit to endure to the finish, I put some scriptures to memory. And hope this doesn't shock you. I refer to these scriptures almost weekly. 1 Corinthians 15:58. Be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that your toil is not in vain in the Lord. And the wonderful promise in Galatians 6:9. Let us not lose heart in doing good, for in due time we will reap if we do not grow weary. And I've always been attracted. I know these were words from Paul to Timothy, but his very last words were in 2 Timothy 4, when he said to Timothy, I solemnly charge you, young man, to preach the gospel, Reprove, rebuke, exhort, and teach with great patience, for the time will come when people will no longer endure sound teaching, but instead they will gather teachers, and lots of them, who will say what their itching ears want to hear. But you don't go there, Timothy, Steve. You present the truth in season and out of season. Reprove, rebuke, exhort, and teach. Fulfill your ministry. Carry out the gospel that God has given you. All of those scriptures, and there are many more, have sustained me. They've helped me keep it real, but nothing more real than Paul's parting words. 2 Timothy 4, verse 7. I have fought the good fight. I've finished the course. And I've kept the faith. In the future, there awaits for me a crown. And then he adds this at the end. And it's not just a crown for me, but for every single person who endures to the finish. I'd like you to bow your heads and